Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Of course, you know how we begin our show. We begin our show with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I told you back in March we were going to do it every day. I've kept my promise. I think only one day we didn't do it. Part of the reason is I want you to hear the voice of a patriot. Remember, his family was brought to this country, so he is an immigrant. And he is also someone who has courage and is willing to speak truth to power. Now, we need to have courage and make sure that we exercise the franchise, whether you're doing it now with early voting, whether you're doing it by vote by mail, whether you're doing it by absentee voting, or you actually vote on election day. Whatever you do, exercise the franchise. And remember, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Well, if it's Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report. He is the voice of Texas. He's the dean of the Austin Press Corps. And rumor has it, as we Zoom on Thursday morning for our Friday show, he's actually hunkered down somewhere in Houston, Texas, which everybody is talking about because of the incredible turnout in early voting, Scott. I mean, I just keep hearing it over and over again. And that the head of the county government in Texas at age 29 is being looked at as a future bright leader, not only for Texas, but maybe for the country. There's a lot to talk about. And I would love to get your sense of whether you really do think, given the kind of turnout we're seeing, is there a possibility that Texas could flip? You were honest about Beto. You said Beto would be close, but he would probably lose by 2 or 3. You nailed it.
I don't make predictions here, but I try to give people realistic expectations, and I am passionate about this. I'm almost evangelical about this. It's not appropriate for a journalist to try to make predictions. However, what a journalist should do is give you a realistic view of the battlefield so you can understand what's happening, right? So that's what I try to do. And you felt that way, right?
Totally.
I'm here in Houston, where people were standing in line on Tuesday, the first day of early voting. They were standing in line for hours and hours. I was in Austin, where I live, on Tuesday. The lines were very long there as well. Same thing in Dallas-Fort Worth. Same thing in San Antonio. There were about 1.1 million people who cast their ballots early on Tuesday. Now, by the next day, by Wednesday, that had died down some. It's just human nature, Arnie. There are a lot of people, and who knows how many, at least 1.1 million who are willing to stand in line for hours all across the great state. A lot of people who know exactly what they want to do. None of the latest headlines matter. There's nothing that could happen in October that would change their vote in November. So they're ready to go ahead and vote now. And you see them doing that. And there's, you know, basically two kinds of people when it comes to early voting. Actually, there's three kinds. The first is the ones who just can't wait to do it and they went and did it already. Then you have the people who are sort of procrastinators who are going to look at their calendar and their watch and they're going to go, oh, wow, early voting is almost over. So the first day and last day of early voting usually represent the most people who vote during early voting. And then you have that third category of people who are just going to, they're going to go when it's convenient, which is actually what early voting is for. I'll actually be taking my daughter. It's our tradition. I'll take my daughter to early vote later today here in Harris County, but it's one of those deals where I'm going to find a polling place where we're not going to wait for hours. She'll probably be in and out in about 15 minutes. This is unprecedented early voting in Texas. I don't want to underplay that at all. The question here is whether this is a really just sort of a front-loaded version of the overall vote we're going to see in Texas. Do we have about 10 million people or 11 million people who vote in this state? Let me give you some perspective, because these numbers can sound crazy, right? I mean, the number of people who voted in Harris County on the first day is larger than the entire number of people who had early voted in the entire state of Georgia to that point. Put that in perspective, Harris County, population-wise, is kind of about the size of Alabama or Georgia, one of those lesser states. If you go back to 2014, let me give you some perspective on the exponential growth and how many people are participating. And you know, Arnie, that we often talk at quorumreport.com about the idea that people are either civilians or combatants in politics. That's something that was coined by my publisher, Harvey Kronberg. He's talked about the idea that President Trump, more than anybody else in his lifetime or yours and mine, has converted more people from civilians into combatants than anyone else. Right? I mean, people are really paying attention here. I was thinking about it in these terms, Arnie. We hear about how we're so divided in this country. Everything is polarized and everything's, you know, split down the middle, Republicans over here and Democrats over there. President Trump, in a lot of ways, rode that division to the White House. It may be, and who knows, in the final analysis, it may be that President Trump proves that we're not that divided. If this is a lopsided election against him, at least there'll be some consensus that we don't like that. Right? That there are plenty of Republicans, too, who would say they're not pleased with the way that the president has done things and handled things and, you know, presided over all this chaos for 4 years. So if you go back to 2014, you are looking at an electorate in Texas that's around 4 to 4.5 million people. I bring up 2014 because that was the previous midterm before 2018, which shattered a lot of records. In 2014, roughly 4.5 million votes, something like that. 4 years later, the electorate had doubled to 8.4 million people voting in Texas, which was presidential level turnout in Texas, which kind of hovers around 8 million people or so historically. We are now up to about 16.9 million voters who are registered in Texas. Of those 16.9, about 14 million or so are non-suspended, because people get their voter registration can be suspended for a variety of reasons without getting into that. You have about 14 million people who can exercise the franchise here. I would expect, because we saw such big growth from one midterm to another, what does that mean for the presidential turnout this time? It could mean that we could see voting at about 10 million, 11 million, maybe even 12 million people. Some insiders in Austin in the political process are saying that they do expect that whoever wins a statewide election, that'd be President Trump, that'd be, you know, Senator Cornyn, or their Democratic opponents, Joe Biden or MJ Hager, they would have to get 5.5 to 6 million votes to be able to win in this state. If people are going ahead and just voting early, which means they're not waiting for election day, it doesn't necessarily mean we're going to get up to, you know, that 14 million mark or 13 million mark. It does just mean, though, that Democrats are very fired up to go ahead and do what they were ready to do for months. At my polling place in Austin, Arnie, people got there at 4 a.m. waiting in line. I showed up at about 6:30 in the morning and saw some people with pillows on the sidewalk. And I said, you know, what are you doing? The conversations I had led me to this conclusion, which is when you're willing to do that, you're willing to sleep on the sidewalk. I mean, this is not a new iPhone, Arnie. These people want to vote. When you're willing to do that, it means that you are not happy about what's going on. People are not showing up at 4 a.m. to vote because they're happy. They're showing up because they're upset and they want to make a change.
Okay, so two things I'm thinking about as I'm listening to you. Because we see this huge rise in voter registration, the question is, you don't do it by partisanship. So you don't know whether it's a Republican voter registration card or a Democratic voter registration card. You just know that there's generic voter registration. Am I correct with that?
Yeah, we don't register people by Republican or Democrat. However, we do have past primary history to look at for voters, so we can start to see what kind of folks are showing up at the polls. And we can also look at what these precincts look like. I mean, you know which areas in your state and we know which areas in our state are the Democratic areas versus the Republican areas. I would say, looking at some independent analysis of what happened on the first day of election, first day of early voting, that you could probably see almost a 60-40 split between Democrats and Republicans, that it really is Democrats who are showing up early to vote. What I said about those who are upset with President Trump being the ones that are, you know, really turning out so far, that's also borne out by some of that data. So you probably have close to 55% or so of those who have voted early so far probably that many are Democrats, and you might have like 35% or so who are Republicans. And then there is the fact that there are about 10%. I'm just looking at my numbers here, Arnie. There's about 10% of those who voted early on the first day who have no history of voting in a general election in Texas. You can see that as well. So at least 10% are brand new people.
Right. The reason I ask this is I'm going to go down a little bit of memory lane. I ran the year of Bill Clinton in 1992. It was also the year of Bush and the year of Ross Perot. Do you know what we found out? If Ross Perot had not been on the ticket in New Hampshire, I could have been in a dead heat with Steve Merrill. But what we found out was we had the second highest Perot voters in the country. 15% voted for Ross Perot. They had no history of ever voting in a presidential year. So we didn't know who they were, and we have same day registration. Think about that, Scott. So we didn't know who they were. We couldn't identify them because they showed up on election day with no history. And then what did we find out? About 2/3 of them voted for Ross Perot and walked out. They didn't vote for anybody else. And then those that were left voted straight Republican. Yeah. So my concern about who these new registrants are is who spent the most time figuring out who they needed to register. Did the Republicans realize that they needed those white, non-college educated people who have no history of ever voting? And did they get them into the registration path so that they could vote for Donald Trump in the general election? Who did a better job of that in Texas?
We're going to find out. There was an effort that was announced late last year into the beginning of this year. It was called Engage Texas. It was about a $13 million super PAC that was established for the purpose of registering Republican voters. And you know how they do this, Arnie, and Democrats do a version of this too. You would walk out of the supermarket and somebody's standing there with a clipboard and they would ask you some questions like, are you pro-life? Do you like the Second Amendment? And that sort of thing. And if you answer the way they'd like you to answer, then they say, oh, well, are you registered to vote? We can sign you up right now. Like I say, Democrats do a version of that as well, trying to identify those potential Republican voters and get them on the rolls. But that effort was closed early in the year, citing concerns of the pandemic, where they said we can't necessarily go and register these folks, you know, in person to get them signed up because people are quarantining, you know, they're staying at home. There was some speculation and talk about how the idea that maybe that effort wasn't going well, and so the pandemic was used as sort of a cover to say, we're not doing well with this. And Republicans and Democrats both realized that they needed to get more people signed up, but I'll give you an interesting piece of perspective here, Arnie. When Cruz and O'Rourke, when the dust settled after their race, they were separated by around 200,000, 250 votes, 250K, something like that. And there were more than in the last few weeks of registration in Texas, because that closed earlier this month. In the last few weeks of registering voters, more people were registered to vote in Texas than the number that was the difference between Cruz and O'Rourke. So who knows who those new people are? One of the big problems that we have as far as trying to read the tea leaves here and try to figure out, you know, who's winning this game is that there are still so many people moving to Texas every day. There are still 1,000 people moving to Texas each and every day, even during the pandemic. Those people, if they drive a car and they get a driver's license, guess what? They're registered to vote, whether they're even politically active or not. You know, when you go and get your driver's license, there's the little box on the form. Yeah, you want to register to vote. Everybody says yes, you know, even if they're really not going to do it. So you have all these people registering to vote. Most of these people are moving to suburban Texas, which is said to be the real battleground now. Those counties around Dallas-Fort Worth, also parts of Harris County, where I'm talking to you from today, and the outer counties here, Fort Bend County, and some others as well, up in Dallas-Fort Worth and down around Austin. If 1,000 people are moving here every day, but you have a pandemic going on, you can't even go talk to them the normal way that you would. So the way that the campaigns have worked, and this is the way I've said it to business groups lately, giving speeches to these various organizations, the campaigns are changed fundamentally, Arnie, in two ways, one that's man-made and one that's not. The one that's not is the virus, right? So it has changed the one-to-one voter contact efforts of candidates. When you're trying to win a local race, like a Texas House race, you've got to be walking the blocks. You've got to be talking to people at their homes. You got to go knock on the door and have that face-to-face interaction, right? It's the way that you differentiate yourself from other races on the ballot too, because Republicans have the very serious challenge of differentiating themselves from President Trump. Republicans, for the most part, have been doing that. Democrats, for the most part, have not been doing that, except since I talked to you last week, there are three or four Democratic candidates for Texas House who have started to do traditional block walking. Now, they're wearing masks and they're keeping their distance from people and everything, but they're knocking on the doors and they're talking to people in their neighborhoods, which is something that a lot of folks have said they need to go ahead and do as we get into early voting. Before this, they had been trying to be respectful and stay away from folks in the midst of this pandemic. We'll see how much that matters. You did see that Beto O'Rourke, who's doing, you know, his effort to try to help Democrats win the majority in the Texas House, he announced that just this week, with the help of Willie Nelson and Oprah, rallying the folks who are making the calls, they announced that they had contacted by phone 2.9, just shy of 3 million registered voters in Texas, talking to them about voting for Democrats up and down the ballot. We'll see how much that matters. And I mentioned that there's another way in which the voting has changed, and it's man-made, which is we don't have one-punch straight ticket voting anymore in Texas, Arnie. And we've talked about this before, but it's going to be fundamental in the way these elections go. There are a lot of people, to your point about the Ross Perot voter, there's a lot of people who are going to go in there and vote for president and not vote for anything else.
Exactly.
And who knows what that percentage is. The Biden campaign, the Biden-Harris signs here in Harris County and up in Dallas County that I've seen, they say vote for every Democrat on the ballot. They have at the presidential level, they understand that the game is different in Texas now. This is the first election where we don't have one-punch straight ticket voting. And so anybody who says they know exactly what that's going to mean for the way Texans vote, that they're getting out ahead of themselves. They don't really know what they're talking about just yet. This is a grand experiment in how that's going to work. And with all of this focus from Beto O'Rourke and national groups that have come in and said they're spending millions of dollars in Texas to try to quote-unquote flip the Texas House, they have their work cut out for them. A vote for Texas House, that has to come from a very motivated person in a place like Houston or a place like Dallas, because those races are 10th on the ballot after the presidency, the United States Senator, judicial races, you're a member of Congress and all of them, statewide races like Railroad Commissioner. Texas House is number 9 or 10 in some of these counties. For these folks who want to vote for Democrats up and down the ballot, that is a message that the Democratic campaigns are saying. But you know, Arnie, from the experience that you shared in this conversation and in your other experiences in politics, you know, y'all know all too well in New Hampshire that the presidential just outshines everything else in a way that it's orders of magnitude larger than every other race.
And I want to compare this to 2016 in a really interesting way. I believe it was in the state of Michigan. In the state of Michigan, what they have is they have what's something called like the undervote. Usually that people walk in and they're so disgusted with who's running for president that around 40,000 people in Michigan normally don't even choose the presidential candidate, but they choose the local offices. In 2016, that number doubled. They couldn't stand Hillary. They couldn't stand Trump. And they just basically walked away from the presidential campaign in Michigan because they both had such a negative connotation. This is such an interesting race because I think the fear in places like Texas is the opposite could happen. They could go in, just vote for president, and then not go down the rest of the ticket, which exactly sort of talks to what you're saying is that this means you need to develop the political muscle, the voting muscle. And that muscle doesn't mean you check one box. That muscle means that you need to walk down the entire voting ballot and go down and vote for everyone, which is going to be so interesting. You mentioned, before I let you go, because there's so much on our plate, right now there's this circular firing squad, especially when it comes to the U.S. Senate race in Texas, which is so important with Cornyn and Hager. Tell me what is happening. Tell me about the money that's coming in and how are they being so negative even within their own campaigns?
Oh, there's circular firing squads in both parties. One of the things that always makes me chuckle, Arnie, is that if you talk to Democrats always think that Republicans have all their stuff together and they never fight with each other, and Republicans think the same thing about Democrats. Neither of those are right? But everybody has these sort of intra-party fights. The Democrats, in this case, I think it's in part, Arnie, it's not having any muscle memory for having a real primary in their party. For so many years, for a generation, really, if you were going to run for statewide office as a Democrat in Texas, it just meant you were ready to retire from politics. You were going to lose, and then you would never run for anything again. I think that may not be the case anymore. I mean, you see Beto O'Rourke ran statewide in Texas, and he's still on the scene and is still taken seriously by folks. And there's talk about whether he would run for governor in 2022. He says he's not even thinking about that. And I would add, for now, we'll see. But in this race for Senate, it got so nasty. There's a Democratic senator, state senator from Dallas named Royce West, who is African-American. And he did have just an ugly, ugly primary and primary runoff with M.J. Hager, who is, you know, of course, a veteran, somebody, a Purple Heart recipient, somebody who, somebody to be respected.
And someone who the DNC wanted to be.
That's right. Isn't it interesting that the Senate Democrats in Washington were really in favor of M.J. Hager right out of the gate? And isn't it interesting that every moderate Democrat just happens to be a fighter pilot, you know, some of the ex-fighter pilot? Look, respect her service and everything like that, of course. But after this nasty race, as the nominee, Hager hasn't done anything to sort of bridge the gap and try to deal with the rift in her own party. They had about 1 million people vote in a July runoff during a pandemic in that U.S. Senate primary runoff, and they were only separated by about 30,000 votes. Senator West was within 4 points of M.J. Hager, and because she was so well-funded, a lot of folks didn't think he was going to give her a run for her money like that, but he did. And you know, Arnie, when there's a nasty primary, if you become the nominee, one of the things that you have to do, especially when the party's that evenly divided, you got to do the work to bring the party back together, right? I mean, Biden has done that, right, in trying to work with those who are further to his left, like Bernie Sanders and AOC, and they're all on the Biden train, right? They say that they don't necessarily agree with him on everything, but they say that it's more important to beat President Trump, which is, to your point about 2016, that's very different from 4 years ago. Remember, Bernie and all those folks were not on board with Hillary Clinton at all for a variety of reasons, and I think Clinton sort of made that same mistake, that didn't do the same kind of work to bring the party together. Well, here's what happened. M.J. Hager was accused of being racist by Senator West and by Senator Cornyn. Cornyn, who likes to, you know, twist the knife and jump in on this thing. Hager had, during the primary, suggested that because he was an African-American, that there's no way that he could be a successful attorney and state senator without being corrupt. Senator Cornyn said, well, that's how she treats people. And so now this has been showing up in some of the advertisements for Senator Cornyn attacking M.J. Hager. I don't know how effective that's going to be. And I don't know that there's any real evidence of her being a racist. We should say that. Certainly she says that she's not, and I don't really see that. But, you know, all this inter-party fighting is not helpful. But then on the Republican side, to be fair, they have their own squabbles. So right now, you have the Republican Party of Texas chairman, Alan West, the former Florida congressman. Just this last weekend, Arnie, 2 days before early voting is starting, he was holding a protest at the Republican governor's mansion in Austin. He was saying that, look, I don't care that people in the Republican Party don't agree with me doing this. You have to do what's right, and you always have to do what's right, and it doesn't matter what the timing is. He and some other Republicans very upset with the governor's coronavirus response. They say that no businesses should be shut down, that there should not be any restrictions like, you know, mandatory face masks and that sort of stuff. And so they are, on some fundamental issues, taking the GOP leadership of the state to task, right as in past years you would have seen Republican chairmen doing everything they could to try to help their fellow Republicans win the election. It's sort of unprecedented.
Well, let me just say something, because as you were saying that is the message to suburban women. If you want suburban women to reject Republicans, you watch what's happening in front of Governor Abbott's mansion. I mean, in a lot of ways, it sort of says, these are the crazy Republicans that are supporting Donald Trump, that ultimately want to like hurt your economy, that want to hurt your health care. And they're even fighting with your own governor, who doesn't have a stellar reputation on fighting COVID anyway. But even what little he has done, they are rejecting. So in a bizarre way, that only helps the Democrats. Because the Democrats are looking at these suburban women going, look at these Republicans. That's what you're getting. You know, even if Abbott is trying to send a different message, how do you send a different message when your party chairman is out picketing your own freaking mansion? It's a movie. You can't make it up.
Nope. You couldn't make up anything better than this.
Well, you couldn't, but this is the chaos of the parties. We're in this sort of negative partisanship where you don't just look at someone as being a Democrat or Republican. You're looking at them as an enemy. But now you've got negative partisanship squared, because now it's happening within your own party. And proof of that is what happened in front of Governor Abbott's mansion. Really quickly, we only have a minute left. I hear that Jill Biden was in Texas. What happened? Good turnout? Is that a sign that Texas is important to the Bidens? Is that what this was about? was kind of code?
She gave a speech that was sort of unremarkable for its substance. I mean, she was saying that, and interesting, Arnie, they had a drive-in rally. Amid COVID, people were staying in their cars while she was on a stage and speaking to a group here in Harris County. She said Texas is in play, and you can take that to the bank. She didn't say that they're going to win in Texas, but it is interesting to have top surrogates for the Democratic nominee for president to be campaigning in Texas as early voting is getting underway. The significance is that it's not so much what she said, it's that she's here, right? And it sounds like Senator Harris is going to be here as well in the coming days, so we'll see what unfolds.
Well, stay healthy, stay safe. Give Houston a hug, whatever you can do with your elbows. Anyway, if it's Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report, the voice of Texas, and the dean of the Austin Press Corps. We'll schmooze next week. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Arnie. Talk soon.
Okay, ciao. Stick around, everyone. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. We'll be right back.
One man's trash is another man's million-selling record.
Bye-bye, love.
You're on The Soundbeat.
Bye-bye, happiness. Hello, loneliness. I think I'm gonna cry. Bye-bye, love. Bye-bye, sweet caress. Hello, emptiness. I feel like I could die.
The Everly Brothers released Bye-Bye Love in 1957. It would propel Don and Phil Everly to music stardom. Not bad for a song they found in the proverbial junk pile. The song had been considered and rejected by 30 other performers before them. Maybe the Everlys had a thing for the underdog. A year earlier, when their first single with Columbia Records flopped, the brothers had been promptly told, bye-bye.
Bye-bye, love.
They recorded this song with Cadence Records. It went all the way to number 2 on the charts, planted firmly behind Elvis Presley's Let Me Be Your Teddy Bear.
Bye-bye, sweet caress.
The Everly Brothers have a non-Elvis Graceland connection. Find out more at soundbeat.org. Soundbeat is produced at the Belfer Audio Archive, Syracuse University Library. I'm Brett Barry.
Texas, man, as if I couldn't tell. Well, you think you pull your boots on right and wear your hat so well. So pour me my laughter, as I sure do understand. Even Moses got excited when he saw the promised land. That's right. You're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. Texas wants you anyway. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. Texas wants you anyway. So I was born and raised in Texas, and it means so much to me. And though my girl comes from down in Georgia, we were up in Tennessee. As we were driving down the highway, she asked me, baby, what's so great? How come you're always going on about your Lone Star State? I said, that's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. But Texas wants you anyway. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. Texas wants you anyway. On the road, it looked so lovely. She stood there on the side, and she grew smaller in my mirror as I watched her wave goodbye. Sure enough could sing, but when they came on down to Texas, we all showed them how to swing. Now David's on the radio, and old jam still on the guitar. And Uncle Walt, he's at home with Heidi, hiding in her loving arms. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. Texas wants you anyway. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. Texas wants you anyway. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. Texas wants you anyway. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. Texas wants you anyway. So won't you let me help you, mister? Just pull your hat down the way I do and buy your pants just a little longer. Next time somebody laughs at you, you just that's tell them right. You're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. Texas wants you anyway. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. Texas wants you anyway. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. Texas wants you anyway. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. Texas wants you anyway. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. Texas wants you anyway. Texas wants you anyway.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. A reminder that we are Zooming this show on Thursday morning, so if something should happen Thursday afternoon or Thursday night, we'll be discussing it on Monday. We've come to admire him so much. Bill Curry joins us now probably every week. He is a progressive voice. He ran for the governorship of Connecticut twice. He was an advisor to Bill Clinton. He worked with the nuclear freeze movement. Just an incredibly, incredibly thoughtful man. We've read him at Salon.com. I hope he writes a book soon because I want to read that book because he has so much to say and he says it so well. So let me welcome Bill Curry to the program.
Great to be with you, as always.
As always. So this has been an interesting week. Amy Coney Barrett has spent the week basically not answering anything, but doing it so well. I have to admit, she's very sophisticated at being able to punt on every question that's being asked of her, even things that are sort of black and white, one would assume, and still she's able to divert her answers. So knowing that she's so skilled at not answering anything, I guess I need to lay at your feet, Bill Curry. So how have the Democrats done with this? She's clearly qualified on paper. She clearly is very smart. You've been sort of seeing it, even her deafness and not answering anything. But the Democrats understood they don't have the votes, but they did have an opportunity to explain the consequences of her appointment. How have they been doing?
Okay, in some regards. But there are a couple of things about it that really deeply bother me. And I would just start out by saying, one of the things you have to do is when you see a lie being told or an evasion or an abusive process, you have to name it, and you have to name it in real time, and you have to name it every time it happens. Okay, so what does that mean here? There's an idea that has apparently now become scripture that nominees for the Supreme Court shouldn't talk about either cases they may be voting on or, now taken by Amy Coney Barrett to its logical extreme, anything. There's absolutely nothing upon which she wants to reveal her thoughts on public policy, values, court cases, even the meaning of court doctrines, when asked by Amy Klobuchar, who I thought really, really surprised me with how well I think she's handled all this. There are a couple of people who have really Sheldon Whitehouse far and away number one. But then I think Klobuchar, when she asked her if she agrees that it's against the law to intimidate voters, and she wouldn't answer, and then Klobuchar read her the statute that says, it's against the law to intimidate voters. Let me just stop saying this, and One, this idea that Supreme Court nominees don't answer questions about their views is very recent.
Yes.
For the first 170 years of the Republic, no one suggested that this was a good idea. No one handled their confirmation hearings that way. The very first person to be rejected for a Supreme Court seat by the Senate was a former Supreme Court justice appointed by George Washington, who'd left for a couple of years and taken a position against a trade deal the Senate liked. And when he came back, they said, hey, you're wrong about that trade deal. You're out. And that's how we did this up until the last 30 years. Coney Barrett calls it the Ginsburg rule, because Ginsburg took a far less aggressive stance, but did sort of create this don't answer questions about cases you may resolve. When they say things like, how could a woman with this stellar a record not be put on the Supreme Court? You know, we assume everybody in the Supreme Court got good grades in law school. It's tantamount, really, to passing your FBI exam. Yes, there are no felonies, and she made law review. They're all smart.
Right.
They're all accomplished. Right. If you sent one up to the Senate who wasn't, shame on you. But the question here is exactly what is going to happen to our country. Do your values align with the values of the American people? What will be the result of your being on this court? Last, I just want to say, I recognize this from the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. The Republicans are masters at faux indignation. And Coney Barrett really annoys me when she keeps saying, I've never made any kind of deal. You're accusing me of having a mission. You're questioning my integrity. I haven't seen anybody question her integrity. I haven't seen anybody accuse her of being, quote, on a mission, whatever that means. The simple question about, you know, did Trump ask her about Roe v. Wade? The guy who's promised to appoint no one but a person committed to striking the decision down? No, he probably didn't. Why? He didn't have to. They chose you. The Federalist Society and the Trump administration and the McConnell Senate chose you precisely because there's no doubt. They all know. The American people should also get to know. When members of the committee and Barrett herself muster up all this outrage for something that was never said, they're constantly talking about people denying her religious freedom. It's ridiculous. So anyway, I hope we take from this a lesson. This is not the way to conduct any kind of hearings, but especially judicial hearings. And the idea that a nominee for a lifetime appointment on the federal bench gets to waltz in without telling anybody what he or she thinks about anything is an affront to the democracy. It is not rooted in the Constitution. It is a recent innovation that survives because the members of the Senate find it convenient.
Is there anyone that's giving the Democrats guidance that sounds like a Bill Curry? This could be the drumbeat. This has never happened before, Amy Coney Barrett. People have answered this question. This is in the Constitution. Yes? Can you read the Constitution to me? Yes? Does this mean that you would apply this Constitution to this set of facts? Yes, and you're right. I think Amy Klobuchar did a phenomenal job. We were both surprised at what a good job she did. But that shouldn't have been an isolated Democratic senator. That should have been a pattern and practice of every single Democratic senator that was addressing her. On the question of climate change, for example, she was asked a series of questions, and then when she got to climate change, she couldn't answer the question about climate change. And how come no senator said to her, is it because your father worked for Shell as legal counsel for decades? Are you compromised by your father's work for Shell that it denied climate change? Why didn't someone connect the dots? Is this what's keeping you from the answer? It's in your DNA not to answer this question because your family basically has aided and supported the reality of climate change? Nobody connected the dots with her. I was so shocked.
This is un-American to put you into an institution for life, into the most important undemocratic institution in our democracy.
Yeah.
You have to at least answer these questions. We aren't concerned about whether or not you'll properly footnote your decisions or express them lucidly. Great. We want to know what they are. We want to know who you are. And it's not about whether you brought your family to work for the cameras, you know, which is great. I'm sure she loves them all. No doubt at all that she loves them all deeply. To watch the Democrats sort of playing along with it, was there a Democratic senator who didn't stop to tell her how great her kids looked?
Oh, my God.
It was just a public relations thing. Here was an illegitimate process. This is a president whom I believe was illegally elected with a minority of the votes, doing not what president's been before. When I was with Clinton, the majority of the people we put on the courts, federal courts, were former prosecutors who are not exactly Trotskyites, as I've said before. And that's because Clinton, you know, he was a plurality, not a majority president, and he had an instinct for the center. I think that's a good thing in the judiciary. I'd be happy to have nothing but centrist judges. Fine by me. I still think we'd make a lot of social progress. But the Republicans have purposely taken these extremists who are clearly imposing their values, whether it's guns or abortion or healthcare, corporate regulation. I love Sheldon Whitehouse bringing that up so much.
Oh, my God.
It was just magnificent, showing the connection between the money spent on getting these people appointed by corporate interest and then how they vote. It seemed to me that they had to do a better job.
You mentioned the most undemocratic institution in the United States. It's an appointment for life.
Yep.
It's an appointment for life, and they get to decide whether they have a conflict. There isn't even a rule on conflict of interest. There isn't even a rule. They get to decide in their own head what they want to do. Talk about undemocratic. Talk about no set of rules and regulations. Basically, it's, you know, how do you feel at the moment? And that's the guiding principle. I mean, that's another thing that got me so upset when they didn't even mention on the climate change that her father, and here's the irony, at the lower level, there is a conflict of interest. She has to disclose that. When she becomes a Supreme Court justice, that evaporates.
Yeah, I know.
It's the Wild West on the Supreme Court. People don't know that because we've never been taught that. We've never been taught that.
Part of this problem is the process itself and what we've allowed it to become. And again, we've allowed it to become this mostly as a matter of political convenience. The way these senators talk now, especially on the Republican side, if you did pass your FBI background check, then there's no reason to even have the hearing. Oh, wow. So you checked out. Your resume, your law school transcript was not a fraud and you didn't commit any crimes. Congratulations, you're the Chief Justice. It's an absolute insult to democracy to conduct any hearing this way, but especially these. I want to make one other point, and that is that I just believe the Democrats, as always, their preoccupation with form over content, with message over policy. Someone decided, as they did with the impeachment on the Ukraine, that the American people couldn't follow more than one thread at a time, and that they had to pick the one that was easiest for the voters to digest. And they've decided that it's healthcare, to the exclusion of virtually all of the things. There's been a little bit of discussion of Roe v. Wade. I would just point out that Roe v. Wade is at least 10 points more popular than Obamacare. It does express that there are lots of heartfelt disputes around the margins of this issue, late-term abortions, et cetera. Lots of legitimate moral discussions. The fundamental idea at the heart of Roe v. Wade is a matter not just of stare decisis of precedent, but of consensus of American public opinion. This woman, if she's elected, will probably end Roe v. Wade. I would feel better. One, I think it's in their interest. If any strategy seems even a tiny bit risky, Democrats never want to pursue it. But you have to take risks and you have to explain your position. I regret that many things were left out of this in the monomaniacal attempt to get across the message about healthcare, which I don't think is quite as simple. People care more about healthcare, but I don't think the argument they've made has been all that easy to follow, as with impeachment, by the way. There are other things that I wish they were being brought up. Number one, Roe v. Wade. And number two, by the way, when she declines to answer the question, go back to my first analysis, when she declines to answer the question about whether a president is required to enable the peaceful transfer of power.
God.
And we know that the man who appointed her wants her to take that position, which is subversive of the Constitution of this United States and of our democracy. Shame on them. But for God's sake, stop that and get angry. Tell her at that point, politely, firmly, clearly, what a horrible thing she would be doing to this democracy and this constitution in the name of her own partisan faction and ideology.
Well, what more than what a horrible thing she would do that she could not answer, that she refused to answer. The level of immorality, again, holding it up and reading it to her going, you read, you have a high IQ, you've taught law. What does this mean? If you were in front of a class, would you be punting or would you be explaining? Well, this is the class. It's the American people. Please explain these words and tell me why you refuse to answer.
Imagine if she is, as we all expect, confirmed, and Trump impounds ballots. The tendency of all conservatives to look upon the electorate as a mob and all Democrats as corrupt. Could I see someone who is as much of an ideological automaton as Barrett voting in such a way as to throw out legitimate ballots? It was done on a smaller scale in Florida. It could be done across the country this time. That's exactly what they're planning on doing. You know, I listen to bright people in the Senate who are Republicans tell me that they all believe all these stories about corruption and mail-in ballots. There's no proof, but they say it every night on Fox News. They say it on CNN. They say it wherever they go. Is she one of them? Because that would be the end of the American experiment.
I am correct here, but wasn't she one of the legal counsels on Bush v. Gore in 2000?
And she was. And she was involved with questions of who got to be, vote by absentee ballot and who didn't, which is exactly on point.
That's my point. And how come I didn't hear the connecting those dots for the American people as she refused to answer that question? That would be the buildup to her inability to answer that question. I know why you're not answering that question. And let me tell you why, because this is your history. NBC has decided to give Donald Trump time for a town hall meeting tonight. Why?
Well, of course, it's a long, happy relationship between Donald Trump and NBC. If it weren't for NBC, we wouldn't have Donald Trump.
Right.
It's something about what we believe about truth and the importance of truth. Mark Burnett and Jeff Zucker, Burnett was producing the show and Zucker was running the network at the time Trump got the deal. They knew it was all a lie. They knew that Trump was being presented as something he wasn't, a successful businessman. They were enabling him to do the only thing he'd ever done successfully, which is lie and brand people with his name. Once they made him a celebrity, he found the only business he ever made money at, which is selling his name, putting his name on the work of others.
Right.
Which is the only thing he's ever made money at in his life.
Yeah.
And it's stunning, the amount of the fraud that's been perpetrated here and how easily it was peddled are lessons to us all.
That NBC is continuing to whore itself out and embrace that lie and provide him with opportunity. Once again, we see what he did in 2015 and 2016. He was a ratings god. It was about a ka-ching. It was about eyeballs. It wasn't about truth. He played them. And I keep thinking, what lessons did NBC learn? You explained tonight.
Zippo.
Thank you.
Yeah, Zippo. Again, they ought to be ashamed. So Trump backs out of the debate. By the way, he wouldn't do a virtual debate. Is he doing a virtual town hall tonight? I assume that, and I'm praying that NBC isn't letting him get into the same room with a whole bunch of other people. In any case, they're giving him the chance to have a night without contesting Biden. A night to himself on their network and undercutting Biden, who played by the rules, was offered a town hall. They should all have offered Biden the town hall.
Exactly.
That's
exactly
what should have been done here. When we look back on 2020, on this election, it'll be painful to look back on the entire year. I hope it's less painful to look back on this election. But one of the things we will conclude is that the media, after all the mistakes it made in 2016, learned nothing and changed nothing. The true critique of our mainstream media is that it seems impervious to all criticism, to all the life lessons of experience itself, to all self-reflection. They've been chasing the same ratings rainbow with Trump this time that they did last time. There's a little bit of, you know, around the edges, some people have gotten a little better, but nothing's really changed. Their coverage hasn't become more substantive. It's every bit as horse race as it ever was. It's every bit as fixated on the kinds of minor diversions in which Trump specializes, and it's every bit as much fixated on Trump himself. It's a tragedy. And this NBC decision to compete with the Biden town hall, with a town hall for the guy who harpooned the debate,
it's
inexplicable. Inexcusable is the word I'm looking for, actually.
Yeah. I need you to get that off my chest, because that's what I have been thinking. There are two quick stories if we have time. One was a USA Today report. About 75,000 more Americans died from COVID-19 pandemic than reported in spring and summer, study finds. Now, the reason I want to talk about this is I have a guy who writes for the Chief Leader. So he's been covering New York and the New York public unions forever, all right? In the late spring, early summer, he talked about that huge spike in deaths and in COVID in New York. And he talked about the fact of how many people had died at home, and that they never went to a hospital, they were never tested, but that the number of deaths at home had spiked because he was talking to the EMTs. He was talking to the ambulance people. They could see it. That story never became part of the narrative. And now, just before the election, they're telling us that there may be 75,000 more deaths. Imagine if that story had been tracked in June and July and August and September. So the real numbers would be coming out. Remember how many people don't have access to healthcare. Remember how many people are dying in the shadows. We could have been tracking that number. And once again, it would be part of the legacy of Donald Trump. I'm glad this story comes out, but I've known about this story, Bill, on my little tiny radio station and have been talking about it since June, and now it's October. You talk about the media letting you down. I read that and I wanted to weep.
The one thing I will say for the media on COVID is that it's the only issue on which they take their coverage of the issue and insinuate it into their coverage of the campaign. Climate change, you have the New York Times writing great stories about climate change on one side of the paper, and stories about the campaign that aren't that great that leave climate change out of it.
Completely.
There was never a point where an editor said, you know, I think the biggest things here are the safeguarding of the middle class, fighting climate change, and staving off the corruption of the democracy. Let's make sure we hold these candidates really hard to account on those issues, and let's make sure we keep those issues central to our coverage. They don't do that. You know, they just go on in this kind of ADD sort of style from whatever distraction was thrown out from the morning to the next one thrown out that afternoon. Again, it's a tremendous, tremendous failure of their own duty as stewards of the democracy.
Remember when Elizabeth Warren, and I know it's been talked about, the idea of doing a tiny, tiny tax on stock transfers so that you could then accumulate these, you know, billions and trillions of dollars of income. It really wouldn't impact anyone except people that were churning the market. It would not be so debilitative, but that it would be a revenue device. It turns out, Bill, that the state of New York has had such a tax. But guess what? In 1981, they were afraid that it would offend Wall Street. And so what did they do? They didn't repeal the tax. They collected the tax and gave it back to Wall Street. Lo and behold, we're looking at a huge economic implosion. New York knows that even if Joe Biden wins, they're not going to see any kind of money to the middle of 2021. The amount of economic holes that exist, there is a law on the books already that could produce billions of dollars for the state of New York. But what they need to do is, instead of returning it to Wall Street and the investors, that they actually keep the money and use it to begin to sort of create this more sort of stability in New York. That law was just like discovered again. We're seeing it moving through possibly the New York legislature. But we've already had the experience. And look what we did. In 1981, we were so cowed that instead of being able to use it as a revenue device, we gave it back to the very boys that described the 2008 economic meltdown that now basically have seen come roaring back during the pandemic as everyone else is being hollowed out economically. I wanted to share that story with you because as we listened to so many people talking about that during the campaign, the primary campaign, and people were rolling their eyes going, we can't do it. We did do it. We just gave up.
Let me just say about that tax. Actually, my friend Ralph Nader has been pushing this for 20 years that I can recall. I don't know whose proposal it really was to begin with. Perhaps we don't even know. It's a great proposal. Among the many things that can be said for it, one, it's about as progressive a tax as you can impose. And secondly, it has a nice effect on the marketplace. We have too many transactions. I don't know why we still call people who buy stocks investors. Clearly, they are speculators. Clearly, the speed at which these institutions churn their transactions is a detriment to our society, not a help. So this tax does two things at once. It takes an activity that has actually become, again, subversive of our economic good, and it raises a fortune, by the way, because there's so many of these transactions. It raises a lot of revenue from the people who ought to be paying the tax at the very top, and it does so in a way that actually deters behavior that is not conducive to our security and prosperity in the long term.
And I need to let you go, Bill Curry. We should keep you on for an hour. Bill Curry joins The Attitude every other Friday, and now maybe every Friday. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Thank you so much, Mr. Curry, for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Talk to you soon. Okay, take care.
Okay. All right, everyone. We'll schmooze on Monday. Ciao. You
think about what you're trying to do to me. Think, let your mind go, let yourself. contained.